It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk about the news that Facebook experimented on its users without their consent. A law and bioethics expert will talk about the ethical and legal issues the news raises, and we'll ask you what you think of the experiment.
First, a look at new recommendations from the American Academy of Pediatrics. The pediatricians group is now telling parents, hey, read aloud to your kids more or less from birth.
Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria is with us now. He's an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and the medical director of Reach Out and Read Wisconsin. Dr. Nafsaria, welcome back to Central Time.
Great. Thank you for having me.
So this week, the American Academy of Pediatrics saying, start reading to your kids at birth. You probably heard this and said, yeah, I got there first. This makes sense to me. I've been saying this for a while. But the argument, what is it? Why should parents start reading that young when the kids can't understand the words yet?
That's a great question. And yeah, the Reach Out and Read model has been around for 25 years. So this is the first time we're seeing it in an official academy policy. Really, it's about two things when it comes down to it. One, we're trying to make sure that parents are being able to provide good language to their children, that their children are hearing their voice, they're hearing what they have to say, they're hearing vocabulary, they're hearing a loving, nurturing voice. For many folks, you might say, oh, well, you just talk to your child, that's fine. But for others, it's not necessarily so obvious. How do I talk to my child? What do I say? I feel silly. So reading aloud from books provides almost a script, not that we're trying to script the interaction, but it provides a script for parents to follow when they're trying to get that language to their child. The second part of it is that as their child gets a little older, they're familiar with books. They understand narrative structure. They understand that books are, you turn the pages in a particular order and all those things, so that when that child shows up on the first day of school for preschool, kindergarten, whatever, and that teacher pulls out a book, they look at it and say, oh, it's a book, and not look at it blankly and say, what is that?
So what are the guidelines? What do they say specifically?
So the guidelines say a few things. They really highlight the role of anyone who provides well child care, family docs, pediatricians, nurse practitioners, PAs, in really encouraging parents to share books together with their children. We want to make this a part of the well child visit, just the same way we talk about immunizations and sleep and all these other things, that asking parents to share books together, looking for barriers, really working with them to try to encourage this behavior happening at home is really now something that should be part and parcel of every well child visit that's out there.
And what about the material? You know, there are not a ton of books out there for infants. Some of them just have pictures. But what are we supposed to read to babies?
Mm-hmm. Really, as long as they can hear your voice when it's a young infant, it doesn't really matter. We've even had parents in the newborn intensive care unit that we've found reading aloud from the Wall Street Journal, you know, and things like that. You know, a toddler may not have patience for that, but, you know, an infant won't care. Really, any book is fine. A standard picture book, just reading aloud, hearing the words. Once the child is just a little bit older, you know, infants are hardwired to look at human faces. So one of my favorite books to give to a six-month-old is those baby face books where there's photographs of babies.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the babies, it's amazing. They fixate on the front of that book and they're looking at it. And I intentionally point that out and call it out for the parents and say, look at that. Look at how much they're loving looking at that book. And the parents just look at their child in a whole new way and realize that this is not just, you know, a crying, hungry, you know, lump that needs to be changed all the time, but that, oh my goodness, my child actually is learning even at this young age.
So who is this designed to help the most, this program, these recommendations?
You know, honestly, it's global. We want all parents and all children to be able to have these high quality interactions. Certainly, though, we know that the biggest issues come in families that are in low socioeconomic circumstances. They often don't have this behavior modeled for them in their communities and neighborhoods that are out there. We know they're at high risk for educational issues and problems as things go along. And I certainly see this in my own practice working with underserved communities. So those are the folks we want to make sure we're reaching most of all, because we know that reading at home is happening least in those groups. But the fact is that with more smartphones and devices and screens and so on out there, we're even seeing in high socioeconomic families that the reading isn't happening quite as much as you might think.
You were talking about the tone of voice, hearing a loving, kind tone of voice. Does that matter if I'm just reading you know, in a flat voice, is my baby going to get as much out of it as if I read in a really engaged fashion? You know, the kind of inflection that you think babies like, typically.
I think certainly inflection matters, too, to some extent. It's not so much the tone of voice itself, but it's what it represents about the relationship between the parent and the child. If the parent reads aloud in a voice that really says, I'm uninterested in this, what they're really telegraphing to their child is, I'm uninterested in you. Whereas if they're engaging and dynamic, and if they're doing a back and forth, a dialogue, if the baby taps a picture and the parent says, oh, yes, that's the doggy, you found the doggy. What they're doing is they're telling the child that what they think, what they do matters, and that the world will respond to them, and they start to get that back and forth. So it really sets up this nurturing, loving relationship, and that carries over to all sorts of interactions and not just the reading environment.
So part of it is this bond between parent or caretaker and child, and part of it seems to be the word accumulation, that you're exposing babies to language and books early on. Are they both equally important?
Yes, it's the language is so important. From the landmark Risley Hart study that I may have referenced last time I was on, there's a 30 million word gap between the most affluent and least affluent families by the time the child is four. 30 million fewer words that child is hearing, 30 million fewer chances for those neurons to wire in the first 1,000 days of life. And that's really where the achievement gap starts. It's not a middle school thing. It's not an elementary school thing. It's not even a preschool thing. It's the first 1,000 days of life that matter. So this is an attempt to get that extra language, that extra interaction that that children really need and deserve.
Now, you mentioned screens and that right now, you know, the technology is so easy. You know, a very young child can just sweep across a screen and draw a line of color. Are you worried about that as a pediatrician, that books and language are being supplanted at a time when the brain is so young and plastic?
I think some of it is supplanting. It's definitely a displacement effect. I think it's very easy, and you know, I'm a parent myself. I understand how tempting this can be to say, here, I'll put my child in front of this, and I think it's educational, so it'll be fine. And instead, they're not getting what they need from me. They're not getting the language. They're not getting the dialogic reading. They're not getting those back and forth interactions and all that. You know, if a parent tells me, look, we're traveling. I have 50 books on my iPad and I'm not lugging 50 pounds worth of books. Fine. You want to read off a screen? That's fine with me. I think, you know, text is text, words are words, but the parent's the equation there. If we lose the parent, and it's just the technology, then it's just not as effective.
It seems like a pretty dramatic pronouncement for the Academy of Pediatrics to tell people to start reading to babies at birth. Does this signify that this is really a big deal and that parents should be taking this seriously?
This is a huge deal. I mean, this is essentially saying that all these other things we talk about, back to sleep, immunizations, safety, feeding, all these things, this is the same type of advice that's out there, and that we should be giving this advice to families and working with them and looking for barriers and really trying to make sure that children are getting a good home nurturing environment that really stimulates their brains appropriately. To have this in policy is just absolutely incredible. And I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm proud to be a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics and, of course, working with Reach Out and Read so closely on many things.
So if this new pronouncement works and you've got lots of parents and caretakers out there reading to their babies from birth, what do you expect to change 5 years down the road?
5 years or maybe even further. I think that what we will see is more children that are prepared for school. I think we'll see that they're doing better in terms of the supportive relationships they have at home. We'll see less need for remediation in school. And we'll really see their brains starting off from the get-go. Children deserve an opportunity to make good choices. They deserve an opportunity to be able to succeed educationally, and we need to start that from the earliest days of life. And that's really what the statement's about.
Dr. Navsaria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Dr. Dipesh Navsaria, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and the Medical Director of Reach Out and Read Wisconsin.
We're talking to a law and bioethics expert about the news that Facebook experimented on its users, apparently without their consent, resulting in a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
The social media site manipulated what hundreds of thousands of users saw in their news feeds to test how positive or negative content affected the mood of its users. The news has lots of people saying the experiment was unsettling or even creepy.
Pilar Osorio is with us. She's a professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. She's also the ethics scholar at the Morgridge Institute for Research. That's part of the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery. Pilar, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, before we dig into the ethical issues here, can you give us a quick rundown of what Facebook was doing in this experiment?
Sure. So what they did was they were manipulating the content of users' news feeds. So that's the information that one user gets about another or about others. What they were doing with about 690,000 people was they were either decreasing the amount of positive news people got or decreasing the amount of negative news people got. They also had control groups paired up with the positive or negatives. So what they were measuring was then the emotional content of the readers' later posts. And what they found was that people who received less positive news also wrote less positive posts. So their posts had fewer positive words and more negative words. Hmm. On the other hand, people who received less negative news had more positive posts following that. So the ones who received less negative news had more positive words and fewer negative words.
So I'm getting stories about happy puppies. You're getting stories about friends getting divorced. My posts then are happier. Your posts are sadder.
Exactly.
So some people's reaction to this is fascinating, useful information. Some people had serious problems with this. Let's get into those ethical issues now. What do you make of this? What was your reaction when you first read about this?
So I had a combination of those two reactions. I mean, I think this kind of research is important. It tells us something important. On the other hand, there were several ethical issues here. First was arguably inadequate ethics oversight of this study. Second, I think, and sort of glaringly obvious, was lack of informed consent. So the question is whether it was appropriate to do this research without informed consent and without even debriefing people after the fact so that they knew they had been in an experiment. They could report any possible harms. And then I think the third thing was that it's not clear exactly what the risks were or that they were adequately minimized.
So risks, what would those be?
Well, if you were trying to transmit a gloomier mood to somebody, a person who already, for instance, has clinical depression, that might cause them to miss work or to do something perhaps dangerous to themselves. You know, I'm not a psychologist, and so I don't feel like I am the person who could necessarily describe those risks, but that's partly why you have ethics oversight, so that you can call on the appropriate expertise in order to evaluate the risks.
And Facebook, in its response to the controversy the publication this article generated, said, we've got terms of use. I'm paraphrasing wildly here. The gist of the terms of use is you're putting lots of data on here. We're going to use it the way we want to for commercial or whatever purposes we want. It's your price of entry, in effect.
Actually, so the specific language is that they would use your data for internal operations, including troubleshooting, data analysis, testing, research, and service improvement. Mm-hmm. So the word research was in there. And then in the journal article, they say, well, people who signed our terms of use agreed to this data use agreement. And the word research was in there. So that's informed consent. From an ethics perspective, no, that's not informed consent. First of all, the phrase informed consent, if you take it seriously, it has the word informed in it. So informed means that people need to know that they're being asked to participate in research, what the research is all about, what the risks and benefits might be, all those kinds of things. There's actually a regulatory sort of definition, if you will, of what counts as informed consent. Signing a user agreement doesn't count, even if people read that, which most people don't.
Right. I've seen some reaction from people in the internet industry saying, hey, if you are ever on a commercial website, you're being researched. We're trying, half of you get this look at the webpage, half of you get this other one. We're testing which makes you more likely to click here, buy something here. You're a guinea pig online. Know this and live with it.
Yeah, so this is true. Whether or not people know it is another story, and whether or not it's appropriate that they just have to live with it is also an important question that just has happened without any social conversation about it. It is true that there is what's called A/B testing, typically, which is where they will test software. The existing software is A, the test version is B. You have usually small, minor alterations to see if you can achieve some outcome, like getting people to click more often, right? Some computer scientists will say that this went beyond standard A/B testing. And again, I think whether it did or didn't, it's a matter of degree. And it is true that, you know, these are commercial enterprises. They are in the business of selling you, the user, to their advertisers. And they are doing all kinds of things with your data. It is also true that this was an intervention that had potential risks involved. It was an intervention on a very large scale. You know, so I think there are reasonable arguments that there should have been much more ethics oversight for this intervention.
Say a UW psychologist had wanted to do this experiment and said, hey, I'm going to work with Facebook and do this and test the impact of positive or negative news from the UW side or from a university research ethics side in general. What would be the expectation for them?
Right. So interesting you should use that example. This experiment was actually done by a Facebook researcher and two researchers from Cornell University. Mm-hmm. So there were university researchers involved, and this has been part of what has generated the controversy, because typically university researchers are subject to a fair amount of ethics oversight. And so there is a review board called an institutional review board that would have to evaluate the research proposal to determine whether it was appropriate to do this without informed consent, and whether you needed to have debriefing afterwards, and whether the risks had been minimized. So that review was not done in this case. Cornell has a regulatory argument for why they didn't do it, and Facebook, as a private entity without federal funding, was not legally obligated to do it. And as far as anybody knows, they didn't have any ethics review committee at that time when this research was planned and initiated.
And you mentioned the legal side there. Apparently no law was broken, and that's because you just said Facebook is not doing this with, they don't receive federal funding, so they're not bound by federal research ethics laws?
That's correct. They're not, they don't receive federal funding. They aren't part of a federal agency. They haven't signed any contract saying they will follow the federal ethics guidelines, and they're not regulated by the FDA. So they fall into a category, which is a growing category of private entities that that are really either very lightly or not regulated in their research.
Legality aside, ethically, it sounds like you wish Facebook had tackled this differently.
I think just as a strictly ethical matter, there should have been some kind of oversight. There should have been some people who were not conducting the research, who were evaluating the ethics of this research and making sure that the people who were participants, that is all those hundreds of thousands of people, were adequately sort of, that their interests were adequately looked after.
Well, Michael from Milwaukee called, couldn't stay online, says people usually change their behavior if they know they're being watched. That could be why Facebook didn't tell people. So suppose Facebook did this without notifying people. Is there something they can do afterward? Is there something researchers do afterward in that kind of situation?
So there are two points. One is that sometimes it's appropriate to waive the requirement for informed consent, and that situation could be one. But there are ways to design this study, for instance, get consent from people, but tell them sometime in the next 3 months, we'll do this for 1 week. You may be part of a control group or part of an experimental group, right? And so you can design a study where people could have given consent here, I think. But that's, again, that's something that if you have ethics oversight, you have outside people who are raising these questions and helping to determine whether the study design is the best one you could do, the most ethical one that could answer your goals.
We're talking to ethics expert Pilar Osorio about the news that Facebook conducted an experiment on its users without their informed consent.
And we want to hear from you on this one. What do you think about this news? Were you surprised to learn that Facebook was experimenting on its users? Why or why not? And do you think it's ethical for the social media giant to conduct these kinds of experiments without user consent? Call in and let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also send us email at talk@wpr.org. We're picking up our discussion now with law and bioethics expert Pilar Osorio about the news that Facebook experimented on its users without their consent.
And we're taking your calls now. What do you think about this news? Are you surprised to learn that Facebook was doing this kind of social experiment on its users? Why or why not? And do you think it's ethical for the social media giant to do this kind of thing? Call, let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ironically, you can also comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Stephen on the line in Madison. Stephen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I was going to say, actually, that to my knowledge, they did actually receive a small chunk of federal funding for this. I should say the Cornell researchers did. I was reading a news article earlier today that I'd be more than willing to link onto your Facebook page, funnily enough. But essentially it states that the DOD actually partially funded this study in an effort to find out how American people would react to social engineering through a media website like this in case a crisis occurs in which the American government needs to, you know, mediate responses from the public.
Stephen, thanks for the call. I'm not familiar with that exact Department of Defense link, but if there were federal money in this in some way, would that be a big problem?
Well, I think for the Cornell researchers, they would probably be required to have an ethics review if what they did counted as human subjects research. And they would have probably been required to do that regardless of whether or not this particular study was getting federal funding. So there are a lot of nuances and technical details about the regulations. For sure, if it was getting federal funding, then they would have been required to have ethics review if what they were doing as part of the study counted as human subjects research. So they have argued that it didn't. Again, it's a kind of technical thing. They've argued that all they did was help in the kind of general design at the beginning and then help to analyze the de-identified data at the end. And they didn't personally engage in any intervention or get any identifiable information. And so, therefore, they didn't fall within the regulations. That was their argument.
Stephen, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Jennifer on Facebook writes, I was surprised and I don't think it's right, the Facebook experiment. She goes on, the lack of consent is a particularly disturbing precedent. Their official response seemed very blasé, which could indicate they don't find their actions troublesome. What do you make of that?
Well, I think a lot of people, it's clear from the media uproar that a lot of people found this troublesome, creepy. I personally find it creepy. I think, you know, there has been a public conversation, but well, there's mostly been an expert conversation about whether we should extend the regulation of research more broadly to the private sector research enterprise. And I hope that this actually can help spur that conversation and broaden the public engagement with that conversation. There are proposals to revise the federal regulations, but to expand the research ethics oversight into the private sector would probably require some congressional action.
So I could see industry corporations saying, hey, we need to do really basic market research to stay in business. Please don't cross the line there.
And, you know, frankly, I think Facebook is to be commended for the fact that they tried to do this in a very rigorous way, up to the standards where they could publish it in a major scientific journal. And that they did publish it. So they're contributing to the advancement of knowledge as opposed to the many similar entities that are probably doing similar experiments and keeping the information completely as a trade secret. Of course, you know, private entities are doing this kind of research because they're trying to get people to come to their sites, stay at their sites, use their sites, and doing that will give them some market advantage. So on the one hand, yes, it's creepy. On the other hand, don't imagine that Facebook is the only entity doing this kind of thing. They just published, and it would be unfortunate if the fact that they actually contributed to our publicly available knowledge would lead them to be slapped around for doing things that are probably not uncommon in that environment.
Michael on Facebook agrees with you in part. He says, while it's scary, I think it's good that we're learning about how social media impacts people's moods and well-being. So if done right by a corporation or by university researchers, there could be value in the kind of thing they're doing here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's important that we have this kind of information. Then there's a larger kind of social ethics question about what we do with that information, who gets to have it, and how they get to use it.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Joe on the line in Racine. Joe, hi.
Hey, how you doing? First-time caller. I just happened to be flipping through the stations, and I hope you don't lose me. I was calling about this, you know, some people like to call me a conspiracy theory and and when this came out, I wasn't surprised. And, you know, the biggest conspiracy that I can throw out there is that Facebook is connected with DARPA and goes into CIA type stuff. And I would encourage all your listeners to go search the DARPA website. I just got off of it. I look at it regularly and, would urge your listeners to look up DARPA and the connection and the money trail between DARPA and Facebook. And
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. DARPA, Defense Analysis and Research, are in there somewhere. I don't know what all DARPA sounds for. Whether or not this particular project is connected to federal defense research, at least we know about this one.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, going back to the consent issue, one of the reasons we have typically a requirement for informed consent for research is so that people can make decisions about whether participating in that research is consistent with their own values and goals and life plans. And so having an opportunity to know fully about the research you're being asked to participate in and then choose to participate or not, that's partially how people have the opportunity to exercise these kinds of views that the caller just expressed.
So Facebook, this isn't the first time they've angered at least some users by a change they've made, by something they've done. How can they make this good in a way that satisfies you, for one, their users, and maybe paves the way to do more ethically sound research in the future?
Well, I mean, I think they need to have an ethics oversight board. If they don't have an IRB, they need to have something similar to an IRB. As I said, I think possibly at least there were research designs where they could have done this with some kind of consent. You know, there are arguments there, right? Maybe they needed such large numbers in order to see an effect that it wasn't reasonable to think that they would get enough people to consent, right? One could also ask whether it was so important to learn this that it was justifiable to expose people to risk and to do it without consent. But those are conversations that need to be had, and Facebook needs to have some kind of ethics oversight by some people who are disinterested, at least to the extent that they are not themselves conducting that research.
We'll leave it there for now. Pilar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Pilar Osorio. She's a professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. She's also the ethics scholar at the Morgridge Institute for Research. That's part of the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery. It's time for this week's Teach Me What You Know. Today we're exploring the tradition of pickling. Maybe your grandparents knew how to do it or your parents, but if you haven't learned how to pickle foods yet, we'll get you up to speed today.
Our guest is Jennifer McKenzie. She's a professional home economist, food writer, and the author of 6 cookbooks, including the just released Best of Bridge Home Preserving. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, before we launch in, can you explain to us what exactly pickling is?
Pickling is a form of preserving, and everybody's probably had dill pickles. And the way they get that way, they started out as cucumbers, and by using vinegar and other seasonings like salt and spices and things, we actually infuse the vegetables with the pickling liquid. That's what it's called when you mix together the vinegar and the water, and that actually preserves the vegetables so that you can keep them in a jar and process them and have them for months and months to come, long after the harvest.
So the pickled cucumber is probably the go-to one. We've all had those. What are some of the other veggies that really lend themselves to pickling?
Oh, you know what? It's amazing when you start getting down to it. And these are firmer, hard vegetables, for sure. Cauliflower. Like, cauliflower is great. Green beans. I love to pickle green beans. Asparagus, even. Sort of the ones that are porous that will allow the pickling liquid to get in them, but then they stay firm. So those pickled beets are obviously very classic. And you can even go with zucchini and garlic scapes and carrots and, you know, pickled cabbage. Obviously, you know, sauerkraut's pretty famous, and that's a form of pickling as well.
Now, you can flavor it different ways, right? Depending on the vinegar and also the herbs and spices that go into it. What do you recommend?
Yeah, you know what? That's what I really like, because, I mean, a good classic dill pickle, you can't go wrong, and that's usually dill and sometimes some garlic, and then white vinegar so that you're not, you know, adding flavor that way. It's just more of an acid, but you can go with cider vinegar. The one important thing is not to sub vinegars in a recipe, so if it calls for white vinegar or cider vinegar, you need to make sure the percent of acid is the same. So if it's a 5% vinegar, that's okay. You can use cider that's 5% or white vinegar that's 5%. I like cider vinegar. It kind of gives a bit of a mellower, not sweet, but just a slightly sweet. So I like to use that for my bread and butter pickles because it enhances the spices, like mustard seeds and, you know, the bit of sugar and things in a sweeter pickle.
Now, pickling is a little bit cooking, a little bit chemistry, and a fairly complicated process in my experience. Is it something that a newcomer, a novice, can really pull off?
Absolutely, and it's not that complicated if you have a good set of instructions. A lot of people might rely on what they remember their grandmother doing, or, you know, they sort of try and fly by the seat of their pants, and that's not the safest way to do it, because you want it preserved properly. Food can spoil if it's not preserved properly, so you need the right acid level, so the right amount of vinegar. So it's best to get a good recipe that's current, sort of not something from 75 years ago, but something published in the last 10 or 15 years, and follow the recipe and measure the ingredients accurately, and then it's not very complicated. Basically, you prepare your vegetables, you prepare your pickling liquid, you heat it up, and preparing the jars properly is important as well.
Well, let's talk about that equipment. What do we need to can stuff?
A couple big pots. And some mason jars. So I really encourage people to use the proper mason jars that are designed for canning, not your old mayonnaise jar, not your old jam jar, you know, from a store-bought product, because those aren't designed to be reused and heated. So buy the proper mason jars, and then those two-piece lids. So you get the disc part and the ring part, and buy the new disc part every time you use them. You can reuse the rings as long as they're not rusted, but do buy the new sealer part, because that seal on the inside of that lid is what prevents bad things from getting in the jar and stuff from leaking out. So you want a new sealer. And then a big canning pot. You can buy the enameled canning pots, and they're really quite inexpensive. But really, you just need a pot that's going to hold your jars with 1 to 2 inches of water above the top of the jar. So if you have a big stock pot that fits, you don't even have to buy a special canner. But you do need a rack or something on the bottom to make sure the jars don't clunk around and break on the bottom.
You mentioned preparing the jars before you get started. What do you have to do?
Wash them really well. So first check them, make sure there's no chips or anything in the rim, because that can crack in the heat. So check your jars, wash them really well. I like to throw them through my dishwasher on a sanitizing cycle, but you can just wash them in hot soapy water really well and keep them hot. So you don't want to put hot food into a cold jar because that can crack it. So make sure your jar is hot. So keep it in a pot of simmering water. They don't recommend you put them in the oven anymore. I often just, keep them in a sink full of really, really hot water, plop them into the canner for the last sort of 10 minutes to make sure they're really nice and hot. Then empty out the water before you fill them.
Okay, so we've got our prepared mason jars. We've got our fresh tops and our rings. So what do we do with the vegetables? How do we prepare for that part?
Well, the first important part is picking your vegetables because you want really high-quality vegetables and you want them as fresh as possible. So you don't want to sort of, get your cucumbers or your green beans and wait a week or so and then decide to make pickles, because preserving the freshness means preserving the freshest vegetables possible. And also check them for any spots of mold or wrinkling. You don't want to do that because one moldy bean can spoil the batch. So do check them carefully. Choose really high-quality vegetables and then pickle them as soon as you can. Within a day or two of harvest is optimal for sure. So each recipe is a little bit different. Cucumbers, you scrub them. Sometimes you slice them. Sometimes you quarter them. All depends on the kind of pickle you're doing. And some of them you have to salt overnight or for a few hours. So check the recipe. And what salting does is draws out some of the liquid from inside the vegetable, and that makes more room for the pickling liquid to go in. And so that's how you infuse the vegetables with flavor. Something like green beans are actually really easy. You just give them a wash, trim off the stem ends, and you heat those right up in the pickling liquid. So you don't even have to do anything ahead for green beans.
Well, a lot of times when I cook, I kind of wing it. I take the recipe as an inspiration and kind of work from there. When canning, though, can I be so free-spirited?
I would rather not. I would rather you follow a recipe. That said, you can change up the seasonings. So if you like your dill pickled with lots of garlic, you can add more garlic. But don't change the amount of vinegar and water in a recipe, because the vinegar in the water is going to determine your pH. So your pH is what is your acid level, and that's what preserves your product. So don't wing it on that. Don't wing it on the sugar amount or the salt amount. But your other seasonings, you can add some mustard seeds. I know some people add some curry powder. So seasonings you can play around a little more with, but definitely keep to a tested recipe on your vinegar, sugar, and salt levels.
Okay, so we're at the fun part. We're preparing our veggies. We're putting them in the jars. What happens then?
Well, some of them go into jars with the veggies cold. Some of them need to be heated up. So say I'm doing my green beans. I cook my pickling liquid, so I bring my sugar, my vinegar, my water, and my spices. I sent you the recipe for the sweet and tangy green beans,
right.
And those have a bit of sugar, some salt, mustard seeds, celery seeds, allspice, vinegar, and water. Bring that to a simmer and get that really nice and boiling and cooked out, so make sure your sugar's dissolved. Then you put the beans right in and heat them up in the liquid. So you get those all heated up, and then really it's just a matter of filling the jars. So I like to use silicone-coated tongs, and so I empty the jar of my hot water. It's nice and hot. I do it one jar at a time. Pack the green beans in with my silicone-coated tongs. If I'm being fancy, I line them all up in a pretty fashion so they're all standing like, little soldiers in the jar. If I'm just in a hurry, I just shove them in. And then make sure you leave enough room in any kind of pickling you're doing for lots of pickling liquid, because if you pack your jar too full of vegetables, you don't have enough liquid to surround them, and then that's what's going to, be the preserving and the flavor. So leave enough space in amongst the vegetables to pour in the liquid, then pour in the hot pickling liquid. Check your head space. Do you know what head space is?
I'm assuming it's the top of the
jar. Oh.
It's at the top of the jar.
Jar, I was close.
Not car.
Yeah.
Jar, right?
Yeah, so where the level of your liquid stops inside your jar and to the top of the jar, that's your head space. And for pickles, it's about half-inch headspace that you want. So I really, in particular, I measure. I have a little headspace measurer, and I do measure it. and make sure there's no air bubbles amongst the vegetables, because then, you know, you'll end up with less liquid. And you want your vegetables to be immersed in liquid. You don't want them poking out of the top of the liquid. So adjust that. Wipe the rim off so there's no liquid on the rim, because I've never been able to put a jar in, you know, that I don't spill on the rim. So wipe those off and then put those lids on and then repeat till all your jars are full. But putting these into your hot canner, so you've Bring your canning water to a boil first.
Right.
So put all your jars in once they're sealed. Immerse them down with the rack in the canner. So you want the water to be 1 to 2 inches above the jars, the top of the jars in the canner. Bring it back to a boil. And once it's back at a boil, that's when you start what's called your processing time. So everything should be processed in a boiling water canner. I know lots of people never do it, and lots of people have never done it, but I call it insurance. Once you've gone to all that work of filling your jars and picking your wonderful produce and making your pickles, the canning just makes sure the jars are going to seal, and it keeps any of the ingredients inside that might have little spores of bacteria or mold or anything. It kills those so that nothing can grow once you've got the jars sealed. So bring that to a boil. For pickles, it's usually about 10 minutes. And tomato things are a little longer. They need about 20 minutes. But for pickles, it's usually 10 or 15 minutes. And so once the canner comes back to a boil, set your timer. And then after that time, turn your canner off. Leave the jars in for about 5 minutes. And let the sort of bubbling subside in the canner, and that helps prevent, if you ever had the jar where the liquid kind of oozes out the lid after it's come out of the canner, because the water inside's boiling, you know, the liquid inside's boiling, so you don't want it to boil out through the lid.
So we're assuming that all goes well, our jars seal and they cool, and I suppose when you take a bite of these pickles in winter, it tastes like a bit of summer.
Exactly, and that's what, you know, I often find, you know, it's hot, it's steamy, I've got my canner going, I'm like, why am I doing this? And then in February, when it's really cold and snowy and you take a bite, it really is, it's so worth it.
Something that helps us get through the winter. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Happy pickling.
That was Jennifer McKenzie. She's a professional home economist, food writer, and the author of 6 cookbooks, including the just released Best of Bridge Home Preserving.